The Mexican government embarked on privatization in the early 1980s, making it one of the first countries to privatize their state sector. Outside of Eastern Europe, the program was also one of the most ambitious and extensive. This is the first video in a three-part series on privatization. In this video, I will discuss the privatization efforts that took place in Mexico in the 1980s and 1990s. In the later two videos, I will discuss the obstacles that the government faced in its privatization efforts, as well as the results of the state loosening its grip on the economy. State involvement in the economy reached a peak in 1982 when President López Portillo nationalized the banking system. The decade before that, though, had witnessed a rapid rise in state involvement in the economy. From 1972 to 1982, the number of state-owned enterprises increased from 391 to over 1,000, and their presence was in almost all sectors of the economy. Output of these enterprises represented 14% of GDP, and they employed more than 4% of the labor force. More importantly to the financial viability of the government, subsidies and transfers to these enterprises represented almost 13% of GDP. President Miguel de la Madrid, pictured here, took over in December 1982 under dire financial circumstances. In August, the government announced that it would no longer be able to pay the interest on its debt. 1 month later, and without consultation with the president-elect, the outgoing president nationalized the banking system. At that point, the deficit was almost 17% of GDP, and two-thirds of the deficit was due to losses by state-owned enterprises. De la Madrid and his finance officials decided privatization would be the only way to pay back the international debt as well as get the economy growing again. And when I say financial officials, I want to note that De la Madrid's team was the beginning of a new trend in Mexico and in Latin America in general, the rise of the technocrats as policymakers. Two-thirds of De la Madrid's team had graduate degrees, most in economics, and more than two-thirds had done their studies outside of Mexico. Bureaucrats at ministries such as the Ministry of Natural Resources and Industrial Development, called CEPAFIN, which had been so influential in the ISI period, were pushed aside. Despite the fact that De la Madrid's team was ideologically on the same page and were eager to change Mexico's course, reform was slow at first and really didn't pick up speed until the next presidential term. De la Madrid was careful never to use the word privatization. The government sold the reforms to the public by calling them redimensionamiento, redetermining the size of the public enterprise sector, and desincorporación, liquidation, transfer, merger, or selling of state enterprises. The government discussed the inefficiencies of the state-owned enterprises and argued that Mexico would never be able to ramp up export productivity and hence pay off their debt if this situation was allowed to continue. Officials also emphasized how privatization would improve the state's economic performance because their focus wouldn't be so broad. Instead, they would concentrate only on a few key sectors. One issue that came up, however, was that the government consistently failed to define what were these key sectors, which ones were priority, thus creating a lot of uncertainty about which companies might be privatized. De la Madrid chose a politically palatable target by focusing his privatization efforts on small firms. This sector became known in popular language as the chiquilleria sector, translating loosely as a crowd of children. The government mostly sold off these enterprises, but sometimes sold off their assets instead, merged them with other enterprises, or transferred them to state and local governments. They also tried instituting performance contracts to incentivize workers and management to reduce costs and overall become more efficient. De la Madrid's government brought down the number of state enterprises to 412. There was a fair amount of pushback to the privatization efforts, a topic that I discuss in more detail in the second video in this series. But external events in the mid-1980s conspired to give the reformers the upper hand. Oil prices continued to fall during this period, and in February 1985, Pemex dropped the price of oil, which ended up costing the country about $300 million of much-needed dollars. Mexico City also suffered a severe earthquake in 1985. The deficit was still at 10% of GDP, and overall the economic conditions of the country were deteriorating. The country announced to the IMF that it would be unable to fulfill its objectives that it had set out in its 1983-84 agreement with the institution. In response, the IMF canceled the remaining tranches on its loan, and Mexico found few commercial banks that wanted to give the country fresh money. The Mexican government reacted by agreeing to more radical reforms, including more privatization, less subsidies, less price controls, less tariffs, and more incentives to raise foreign direct investment and exports. Carlos Salinas, who assumed the presidency in 1988, embarked on much more radical reform. He went after large and politically controversial targets and seemed unafraid of taking on labor unions. As Judith Teichman notes, if anything, privatization was used as a weapon against labor when it got in the way. By 1992, there were only 225 state-owned enterprises left in Mexico. 96% of the assets that had been privatized had been done so under Salinas's watch. The government had retreated from almost all sectors of the economy. While controversial at first, most utilities were even privatized in the 1990s. The method of privatization employed in Mexico involved first-price sealed bid auctions through a fairly homogeneous auction process, with the value of the bid determining the winner in over 98% of all privatized state-owned enterprises. In all but 8 cases, the government sold 100% of its ownership of the enterprise. In these exceptions, the government held on to a minority stake that was eventually also sold. And unlike what we saw in Eastern Europe in privatization, the top management in these enterprises were almost always replaced afterward. Governments in developing countries face a number of politically sensitive issues when privatizing. First, these governments are typically in dire financial straits and need money right away. This, combined with the fact that state-owned enterprises are typically inefficient and unproductive, means that they often, and probably shouldn't, price these organizations to sell quickly. But doing so raises criticisms that the state is selling off the quote-unquote family jewels for next to nothing. Second, if the country in question is relatively poor, then there will be few individuals with enough money to buy these new firms. The government can open up the bidding to foreigners, but that brings a host of other problems to a populace unhappy with the process. If you limit the sales to citizens, however, this raises the possibility that state monopolies will merely be replaced with domestic ones. And this is exactly what Mexico faced. The pool of possible investors was small, so the purchasing of these state-owned enterprises tended to be concentrated among very few entrepreneurs. For instance, by 1992, 9 buyers accounted for 38% of non-banking public enterprise purchases. 3 banks accounted for 50% of all banking assets in the country. One man, Jorge Larrea, acquired 90% of the country's copper output. He was also the main shareholder in 9 of Mexico's industrial conglomerates. And after privatization, there were 2 airlines, but one of them had a controlling share in the other. Some, in terms of helping the government escape the financial pressures of the 1980s, the privatization program did exactly that. By 1992, the government was running a budget surplus and had paid back more than $7 billion worth of debt. Revenue from privatization was its most important source of money, and 90% of this revenue went to paying down debt. But the concentration of wealth and assets led to charges of cronyism and corruption and cast doubt about Mexico's future competitiveness. A lot has changed in the last 30 years, though, so in part 3 of this series, we'll take a closer look at the Mexican economy and evaluate the results of privatization. The material for this video comes mostly from Judith Teichman's book, Privatization and Political Change in Mexico, which is excellent, as well as a paper by Laporta and López de Solanes called The Benefits of Privatization, Evidence from Mexico, published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics. 2 other articles were also extremely useful. Armando Pinheiro and Ben Ross Schneider's The Fiscal Impact of Privatization in Latin America, as well as McKenzie et al., The Distributive Impact of Privatization in Latin America, Evidence from 4 Countries.